young white people struggle now, that's going to make a major difference.
And Cecile, you nodded your head also. You're hopeful. 30 seconds.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful because we've moved into a new time. As you can see, globally, people are rising up. You know, we have to try something new. What's happening now is not working for us. So I'm hopeful because we must be the change we wish to see.
And on that note, thank you both. Pleasure talking to both of you. Cecile Johnson, human rights defender and author out of Chicago. Charles Simmons, social activist, educator, and political analyst out of Detroit. And thank you for being with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi saying goodbye for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد بعثنا في كل أمة رسولا أن اعبدوا الله واجتنبوا الطاغوت فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَاقِبَةُ المكذبين إن تحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, Serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him, quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. U.S. stocks take a plunge after Fitch Ratings Agency downgrades the country's credit rating over fiscal deterioration and the government's rising debt. Niger's junta rejects international sanctions imposed on the country as illegal and inhumane, vowing not to bow to threats to reinstate the ousted president. And China steps up rescue and relief operations after severe deadly floods in northern and central parts of the country. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. U.S. stocks have taken a nosedive after Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded the country's credit rating by a notch from AAA to AA+. On Wednesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average shed almost 350 points or 1.0%, while the broad-based S&P 500 dropped 1.4%. The tech-rich NASDAQ composite has tumbled 2.2%. Fitch attributed U.S. credit rating downgrades to expected fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years and the government's growing debt. This is the second time a major ratings agency has lowered U.S. rating after S&P made a similar in 2011. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has criticized the downgrade of the main U.S. credit rating, calling it entirely unwarranted. She claimed Fitch has ignored improvements in governance metrics under the Biden administration and the country's economic strength. Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran and Islamabad are opening a new chapter in their relations. Mr. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks upon his arrival in Pakistan's capital city for an official visit at the invitation of his counterpart Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. He added that an economic delegation from Iran has already arrived in Islamabad. Amir Abdullahian said discuss the two countries' relations in such areas as politics, economy, trade, and tourism with high-ranking Pakistani officials. Iran's top diplomat said existence of numerous commonalities between the two neighbors allows them to further expand their relations. He added that during his meetings with Pakistan's top officials, a timetable will be drawn up for Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's trip to Pakistan.
A high-level delegation led by Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Diplomacy, Mehdi Safari, arrived in Islamabad on Wednesday for a two-day official visit. The Iranian deputy foreign minister participated in an important meeting where high-ranking officials from Pakistan and Iran engaged in discussions to actualize a series of pivotal development projects, fostering stronger ties between the two neighboring nations. The two sides discussed the barter trade mechanism between Islamabad and Tehran. In addition to exploring avenues for bolstering economic cooperation and promoting free trade, the officials placed particular emphasis on the border markets, custom relations, and various other agreements reached in the 21st Joint Economic Commission of Iran and Pakistan, which was held in Pakistan last year. Following the meeting, the Iranian deputy foreign minister told Press TV that both nations are resolute in their decision to broaden mutual cooperation across diverse sectors, including trade, energy, transportation, health, and tourism.
We have concentrated to increase the bilateral. Bilateral trade, this is not just making the business, also to joint production. This is very important. We have going to create a common free zone in the borders and to have not just for the trade, also to create factories in the areas of the medicines, medical equipment and the other stuff which is needed for both sides.
A top official from Pakistan's Economic Affairs Ministry said the discussions primarily focused on exploring opportunities for augmenting trade, investment, and technical cooperation across multiple sectors. The areas of focus included energy, agriculture, infrastructure development, manufacturing, and technology.
This is an extremely important forum because we will soon be holding our Joint Economic Commission, which is the forum for resolution, discussion, and agreement on joint outcomes, and we will be holding that Joint Economic Commission in Tehran soon. So this meeting will go a long way in setting up the agenda, in reviewing the progress, reviewing the implementation status of the agreed actions.
Both sides have acknowledged the significance of enhancing bilateral trade volume and have pledged to foster an enabling environment for their respective business communities, unlocking vast opportunities in economic cooperation.
Although Islamabad and Tehran are working to improve their bilateral ties through a variety of diplomatic channels, economic experts believe that two sides can further increase their trade by easing up on their respective restrictions and giving each other better market access. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump is facing an escalating series of legal challenges with criminal charges brought against him for the third time in just 4 months. We have a report.
For the first time, America is set to put on trial a former president in one of the most consequential criminal cases in the country's legal history. Ex-President Donald Trump has faced criminal charges for a third time in 4 months.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The indictment pertains to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat to incumbent President Joe Biden. It focuses on his actions in the two-month period between his loss to Biden and the infamous riot in Washington, D.C. During this period, Trump vehemently denied the election results, repeatedly asserting that the votes had been stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
According to the indictment, Trump knowingly propagated false fraud claims and exerted pressure on state and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, to manipulate the election results. When failed, Trump directed his supporters to stop certifying Biden's win. that turned into a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, leading to 5 deaths, a move that is described as an attack on America's democracy.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
Trump vehemently dismisses the case as ridiculous and maintains his innocence, refuting any allegations of wrongdoing. He even goes further to accuse the prosecutors of being politically motivated, claiming they are acting on behalf of Biden to meddle in the forthcoming presidential elections, in which Trump and Biden could face off again. The two are currently tied in polls. The Trump campaign has also asserted that the Tuesday indictment amounts to election interference. Nonetheless, this is not the only obstacle standing in the way of Trump's return to presidency. The Republican politician has already been charged in 2 other cases, mishandling classified files and falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film actress, the charges that have significantly hit the former president's reputation among many Americans.
I hope he goes to prison for a long time. I think he deserves to go to prison for a long, for all crimes he committed.
Donald Trump is now due to appear in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. He faces 78 criminal counts overall. These charges mean the ex-president will have 3 criminal trials to attend in the next 12 to 18 months, complicating his second run for the White House.
Public confidence in the U.S. military continues to decline. A new poll has revealed that America's trust in the nation's defense agencies have hit its lowest point in over 2 decades. Not only has confidence in the military fallen, but the U.S. has been combating a serious shortfall in recruiting. That's in the tens of thousands.
According to a new poll, public confidence in the U.S. military continues to decline, reaching its lowest point in over 2 decades. Only 60% of Americans expressed a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the military in a recent Gallup poll conducted from June 1st to 22nd. That's down from 64% in 2022. After the 9/11 attacks, military confidence increased and remained high at mostly above 70% for 2 decades in America, before dipping to 69% in 2021. The confidence level has further declined since then. The poll linked the decline to the United States' poorly executed withdrawals from Iraq and Afghanistan. Many analysts have also attributed the trust deficit to Washington's heavy arms supplies to Ukraine, which has been engaged in a war with Russia since last February. Last month, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Kull acknowledged that the United States' military aid to Ukraine has placed the country's arms industry under strain. According to Kull, Washington has provided nearly $40 billion in military assistance to Kyiv since the start of the war. Over the past 48 years, Republicans have consistently shown the highest levels of confidence in the military, but in just the past 3 years, Republican confidence plunged from 91% to 68%. Independents, who historically held moderate levels of confidence, now have the lowest trust, with public confidence dropping by 13 percentage points to 55%. Though confidence among Democrats rose after President Joe Biden took office, that gain has dissipated over the past year. The results mirror a crisis of trust in several other public institutions. The military still evokes the highest public trust among the 14 other institutions included in the poll. 5 institutions stand as the least trusted, with newspapers, the criminal justice system, television news, big business, and Congress all garnering confidence from less than 20% of Americans. Congress, in particular, registers the lowest confidence at a mere 8%.
The fall in Americans' confidence in the Army comes amid a crisis that has endangered the country's military preparedness. Most American youth are now reluctant to join the Army and serve the flag, but what are the reasons?
This This year's confidence index reflected a 4 percentage point decline compared to last year, when an American think tank rated the US military's level of capability as weak, saying it was incapable of winning a single war against arch rivals China and Russia, let alone two concurrent ones. The report prepared by the Washington-based Heritage Foundation only appraised the Marine Corps as strong, while giving the Army a marginal rating, evaluating the Space Force and Navy as weak, and finding the Air Force to be very weak. Also, with public support falling, the armed forces are struggling to fill their ranks. Leaders from the Army, Navy, and Air Force told a congressional hearing in March that they all expect to fall short of their recruitment targets this year. The children of military families make up the majority of new recruits in the U.S. military. The pipeline is now under threat, which is bad news for Pentagon's already acute recruitment problems, as well as America's military readiness. This year, the U.S. Army expects to end up about 15,000 short of its target of 65,000 recruits. But what are the underlying causes of the U.S. military recruitment crisis?
Unfortunately, only about 23% of young Americans qualify these days to go into the military, and a lot of that is about obesity. And some of it also is about just only about 9% of young Americans are interested in serving in the U.S. military. So it's a lot of things wrapped together.
According to a Pentagon study published in March, 77% of the 16 to 24-year-olds typically targeted by military recruiters are unfit for service due to lack of physical fitness, low test scores, drug use, or poor mental health. Also, experts believe that the sexual assaults that occur in U.S. military bases and the arrival of white supremacists to higher military ranks are among the most important reasons that led to the reluctance of young men to go to military service. American officials are now concerned that this trend would lead to undermining the state of preparedness of the country's military forces and may have negative repercussions on the reputation of the U.S. Army.
Elsewhere, the leader of Niger's recent coup has rejected international sanctions, vowing not to bow to threats to reinstate ousted President Mohamed Bazoum.
The National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland rejects these sanctions in their entirety and refuses to give in to any pressure from any quarter. We reject any interference in the internal affairs of Niger.
In a televised address, Abdurrahman Etiani described the sanctions as illegal, unjust, and inhumane. He said the sanctions are designed to humiliate Niger and its defense and security forces and make the country ungovernable. This after West African bloc imposed trade and financial sanctions on Niger and even threatened to use force if the ousted president is not reinstated by Sunday. The bloc has sent a delegation to Niger to negotiate with the military officers who have seized power. West African leaders have said they will no longer tolerate coups in the region. Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea are currently run by as well. Guinea-Bissau has seen an attempted coup. Mali and Burkina Faso have warned that any military intervention in Niger would be considered a declaration of war against them, too. Typhoon Kanun continues to wreak havoc in Japan with intense rain and fierce winds leading to more potential storm damage. Two people are confirmed dead and more than 40 others injured in Okinawa and Kagoshima prefectures. Some 166,000 households are said to be without electricity. Naha Airport in Okinawa has resumed operation after it was shut down 2 days ago. However, hundreds of flights remain canceled in southern Japan. The storm in the East China Sea is now changing direction from northwest to east toward the country's mainland. Its actual path has not been determined yet. Earlier, Kanun also forced schools and businesses to shut down in Taiwan. That says China is still reeling from deadly floods due to the heaviest rain received over consecutive days after Typhoon Doksuri lashed northern parts, including the capital, Beijing. The country has stepped up rescue and relief operations. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye. Thank you.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Texas State Police has purchased a phone tracking software from a Zionist regime company for border emergency. The software was licensed as part of Governor Greg Abbott's troubled Operation Lone Star border crackdown. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Intercept, the Texas Department of Public Safety purchased access to powerful software capable of locating and following people through their phones as part of Republican Governor Greg Abbott's border security disaster efforts, according to documents reviewed by The Intercept. In 2021, Abbott proclaimed that the surge of individuals unlawfully crossing the Texas-Mexico border posed an ongoing and imminent threat of disaster to the state and its residents. Among other effects, the disaster declaration opened a spigot of government money to a variety of private firms, ostensibly paid to help patrol and blockade the state's border with Mexico. One of the private companies that got in on the cash disbursements was Cobwebs Technologies, a little-known Zionist regime surveillance contractor. Cobwebs' marquee product, the surveillance platform Tangles, offers its users a bounty of different tools for tracking people as they navigate both the internet and the real world, synthesizing social media posts, app activity, facial recognition, and phone tracking. News of the purchase comes as Abbott's border crackdown escalated to new heights following a Department of Public Safety whistleblower's report of severe mistreatment of migrants by state law enforcement and a Justice Department lawsuit over the governor's deployment of razor wire on the Rio Grande. The Cobwebs documents show that Abbott's efforts to usurp the federal government's constitutional authority to conduct immigration enforcement have extended into the electronic realm as well. The implications could reach far beyond the geographic bounds of the border and into the private lives of citizens and non-citizens alike. Wolfie Crystal, a privacy researcher who tracks data brokerages, told The Intercept, government agencies systematically buying data that has been originally collected to provide consumer services or digital advertising represents the worst possible kind of decontextualized misuse of personal information. But as long as this broken consumer data industry exists, as it exists today, shady actors will always exploit it. Like its competitors in the world of software tracking tools, Cobwebs, which sells its services to the Department of Homeland Security, the IRS, and a variety of undisclosed corporate customers, lets its clients track the movements of private individuals without a court order. Instead of needing a judge's sign-off, these tracking services rely on bulk purchasing location pings pulled from smartphones, often through unscrupulous mobile apps or in-app advertisers, an unregulated and increasingly pervasive form of location tracking. In August 2021, the Texas Department of Public Safety's Intelligence and Counterterrorism Division purchased a year of Tangles access for $198,000, according to contract documents, obtained through a public record request by Tech Inquiry, a watchdog and research organization, and shared with The Intercept. The state has renewed its Tangles subscription twice since then, though the discovery that Cobwebs failed to pay taxes owed in Texas briefly derailed their renewal last April, according to an email included in the records request. Cobwebs declined to comment for this story. A second 2021 contract document shared with The Intercept shows DPS purchased unlimited access to Clearview Artificial Intelligence, a controversial face recognition platform that matches individuals to tens of billions of photos scrapped from the internet. The purchase, according to the documents, was made in accordance or governed by the Texas governor's disaster declaration for the Texas-Mexico border for ongoing and imminent threats. Clearview did not respond to a request for comment. Each of the 3-year-long subscriptions notes Tangles was purchased in accordance to the provisions outlined in the Texas governor-proclaimed border disaster declaration signed on May 22, 2022, per Section 418.11 of the Texas Government Code. The ability to track a person wherever they go based on an indispensable object they keep on or near them every hour of every day is of obvious appeal to law enforcement officials, particularly given that no judicial oversight is required to use a tool like Tangles. Critics of the technology have argued that a legislative vacuum allows phone tracking tools fed by the unregulated global data broker market to give law enforcement agencies a way around Fourth Amendment protections. The power to track people through Tangles, however, is valuable, even in countries without an ostensible legal prohibition against unreasonable searches. In 2021, Facebook announced it had removed 200 accounts used by cobwebs to track its users in Bangladesh, Saudi Arabia, Poland, and several other countries. The company explained, in addition to targeting related to law enforcement activities, we also observed frequent targeting of activities, opposition politicians, and government officials in Hong Kong and Mexico. Barry Lipton, an investigative researcher with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, told The Intercept that bolstering surveillance powers under the aegis of an emergency declaration adds further risk to an already fraught technology. Lipton said, "We need to be very skeptical of any expansion of surveillance that occurs under disaster declarations, particularly open-ended claims of emergency. They can undermine legislative checks on the executive branch and obviate bounds on the state behavior that exists for good reason."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Palestinian socialist revolutionary, Ghassan Kanafani, was assassinated by Israel's secret service. He was a very effective spokesperson for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. But his eloquence was intolerable to the Zionist entity, which was determined to snuff out the flame of Palestinian rebellion that he represented. Yet his message of hope, ambition, and perseverance has meant that his influence has only grown since his cold-blooded murder by Zionist assassins. In a famous 1970 interview, he said, "To liberate our country, to have dignity, to have respect, to have our mere human rights is something as essential as life itself." So in this edition of Palestine Declassified, we look back at his life and legacy, starting with this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
On July 8, 1972, a light was stolen from the world. The thinker, teacher, writer, and fighter with his pen, Ghassan Kanafani, was killed in a cowardly assassination by the Zionist intelligence agency Mossad in Beirut. The car bomb also took the life of his 17-year-old niece, Lemis. Kanafani was born in Akka, Palestine, in 1936, the third of eight siblings. At the age of 12, he was driven from his home by Zionist racism in the Nakba of 1948. His family went on to settle in Damascus, Syria, which Kanafani wrote about in his short essay, The Land of Sad Oranges. Kanafani studied Arabic literature at the University of Damascus, only to be expelled for his involvement with the Arab nationalist movement of George Habash and Wadi Haddad. Kanafani then moved to Kuwait, where he worked as editor of the Arab nationalist movement's newspaper, Al-Ra'i, The Opinion. Kanafani then moved to Beirut in 1960 and edited another newspaper linked to the organization, Al-Hurriye, Freedom. With the Nexa of 1967, the Arab nationalist movement of Haddad and Habash became the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. The organization would haunt Israel across the planet, carrying out some of the most original and daring operations in the history of the Palestinian freedom struggle. Kanafani worked as the PFLP spokesman and editor of their weekly newspaper, Al-Hadaf, The Aim. In his legendary short stories like Return to Haifa and Men in the Sun, Ghassan Kanafani deals with the Palestinian struggle from several different unorthodox angles. Return to Haifa deals with the taboo subject of children left behind in the Nakba and what possible fate could befall them. The complex but moving story also serves to discredit Zionism as an ideology and the biological determinisms of racism. Men in the Sun deals with the overlapping tragedies of refugees searching for sustainable lives in Arab states. The last words of the short story, which depicts Palestinian refugees suffocating to death in the back of a water tank while trying to enter Kuwait for work, haunt the reader. Why didn't they bang on the walls? The words serve as an eternal reminder to our long-suffering people. Bang on the walls. Long live Ghassan Kanafani and long live the resistance.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Omar Zalza. Omar is a writer, poet, independent scholar and organiser, and he's also a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, as well as the US Campaign for the Cultural and Academic Boycott of Israel. Omar is an assistant professor at San Francisco State University, and he joins us today from California via Skype. Welcome to the show. Omar, I wonder if we could start with you. What did Ghassan Kanafani's works mean to you as a Palestinian?
Well, Ghassan Kanafani, in his works, in many ways epitomized, you know, this kind of uncompromising nature of continuing forward in the spirit of liberation until the very end. Not conceding an inch, understanding that, you know, we, the Palestinians, are a people collectively locked in a struggle against settler colonialism and anti-imperialism. And he really gave life to that sentiment through his works. And in many ways, you know, he served to really collectivize the Palestinian experience, sort of taking individual accounts of dispossession, you know, and violence, and turned it really into a sense of kind of a collective condition that all of us can recognize and that we can use to sort of unify ourselves in the midst of this sort of ongoing quest to liberate land and people totally. So in a sense, you know, Kanafani really represented this sort of undying and unwavering commitment, you know, through his writings, through his organizing, to this ultimate goal. And so in many ways, when we celebrate Kanafani's literary achievements, when we celebrate his literary prowess, we're also paying testament to that sort of unwavering commitment to the need to fully liberate land and people from the river to the sea.
Yes. Well, David, I mean, although it's rare, I mean, Israel does have a record, doesn't it, of assassinating non-combatants, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I mean, back as far as 1948, of course, they started with those kinds of assassinations. There was a former Jordanian MP who also edited the PLO newspaper, Kamal Nasser, who was assassinated. And, of course, most recently, we've seen Shireen Abu Akleh, the journalist, killed just last year. So there is a history of this. But, of course, there is also a history of an assassination program by the Mossad through all sorts of various means, including numbers of the people who we're going to talk about today.
Mm. Well, Omar, I wonder whether you could say a word or two about Ghassan Kanafani's position on negotiations with the Israelis.
Well, there's a famous line, you know, from the interview with Richard Carlton where Kanafani is asked, you know, why don't you talk to the Israelis? Talk about what? And is this talk about not fighting? Kanafani responds, talk about not fighting for what? You know, and then on and on and on. And eventually you get the famous phrase, that's the kind of conversation between the sword and the neck. So the idea that, you know, again, that, you know, and the sort of unapologetic, unwavering stance that, you know, Palestinians are locked in a total liberation struggle for the complete liberation of land and people. And the idea that sort of conceding to the colonial power through negotiation that does not in any way account for the asymmetry of power that the settler colonialism, you know, of the Israeli state and Zionism impose, is tantamount to suicide and is an abdication of the right, of the need, you know, the imperative to fight for the liberation of land and people.
I mean, David, what can you tell us about the transition of the Arab nationalist movement to the PFLP that was mentioned in Latifa's report there?
Well, the watershed is the invasion of the West Bank, of Gaza, and of the Golan Heights by the Zionist regime in 1967. Mm. And the Arab nationalist movement has a shock, a massive wake-up call with that. And it transforms itself into, effectively, a much more ready to fight guerrilla organisation. So the PFLP emerges, it has its armed wing, and that becomes much more of a significant threat to the Israelis. And they engage for many years in many different operations against the Israelis, which really challenge some of the Zionist regime's attempts to suppress the Palestinians and to maintain occupation in the West Bank and Gaza and the other elements of the occupation. So it's a transformation of footing, really, from the Arab nationalist movement to a fully socialist fighting organisation which will directly take on the Israelis. And that's a transformation which we see leading to splits within the Palestinian movement, so that parts of the PFLP, of course, are affiliated to the Palestine Liberation Organization, and other parts are not. So you see the emergence of a much more radical spirit coming through after 1967.
Yeah. I mean, if you maybe just expand a little bit on the structure of the PFLP as well.
Well, the PFLP goes through various iterations, so different factions, and of course there are splits over ideology, but also splits over strategy in terms of armed actions. And of course there's the associated and the allied faction of the Black September, which moves beyond the kind of activities of the PLO, things which are accepted to the PLO. So you have the PFLP proper, then you have the PFLP General Command, GC. There's also, of course, the SC faction of the PFLP. So there's a lot of different factions in there, and that's part of the evolving sense of the guerrilla struggle, which the various different factions are engaged in.
Sure. Well, Omar, I mean, how has the legacy of Kanafani and his comrades informed your work with the Palestinian youth movement?
So we see Kanafani, you know, as really very much an enduring and ongoing and vibrant and galvanizing figure and symbol, not just for who he was as an individual, but for everything he represented. And his example, you know, of the concept of adab al-muqawami, or resistance literature, is something that we really took to heart as the Palestinian youth movement. And, you know, we, among other things, we started the Ghassan Kanafani Resistance Arts Scholarship, which is to really cultivate the creativity in Palestinian youth, Palestinian Arab youth, you know, across the world, basically, to really think about the interconnection between cultural resistance and the ongoing liberation, Palestinian liberation struggle. We see really a need to continue to kind of cultivate this collective sense of being a people locked in an ongoing struggle against settler colonialism, against imperialism, and thinking about how culture in and of itself can, you know, help to kind of actualize that goal by making sure that, you know, we never forget that Palestinians continue to remain engaged, continue to reject concessions to Zionist settler colonialism and to imperialism, and continue to create works that will galvanize and stimulate, you know, and awaken subsequent generations. And I think certainly, you know, when we think about kind of a resurgent, kind of a new sort of waves of resistance among ongoing Palestinian generations, we see that there is an unwillingness to forget, an unwillingness to compromise, you know, the very things that Kanafani, you know, that and his generation were really pushing for, to ensure that we don't concede, that we don't surrender, that we never forget, that this will be a pursuit of liberation from the river to the sea.
Yeah. Well, David, I wonder whether you could say what precipitated the eventual split between the PFLP and Wadi Haddad.
So you have this process of radicalization from 1967 on, and you have the move towards a much more radical approach from people like Haddad. And he even splits from his longtime comrade, George Habash. And there's a split with the PLO, essentially. And that's one of the things which is really of significant relevance today, is the question about the role of the PLO and, of course, the Palestinian Authority in actually interfering with the liberation struggle, as opposed to fostering the liberation struggle, which was supposed to have been the PLO's role. And this is an early sign of the tensions inside the Palestinian national movement, where the PLO starts to in some senses, compromise, and elements of the PFLP are unwilling to compromise. And, of course, that puts them right outside the space where the Israelis are happy to negotiate what's happening with the PLO. And, of course, today's security cooperation there is between the Palestinian Authority and Israel is a key weeping sore within the liberation movement. But you have someone like Haddad, who is unwilling to compromise, is associated with Black September, and eventually, of course, what happens is that the Israelis assassinate him. Yeah. I mean, really, really vicious means of assassination. They sneak into his apartment. They change the toothpaste in his bathroom for a poison, so that every day he brushes his teeth, poison seeps into his system, and they don't know what's wrong with him. Eventually, Arafat sanctions him, being sent to East Germany to a specialist hospital, and they can't even work out what's wrong with him. And he dies in horrible pain. And this is typical of the Israelis, the kind of strategy they've used to assassinate people who are outside the scope of negotiation. According to their strategies.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment to report about another Palestinian non-combatant, Neji al-Alali, who was also assassinated, and also about Israel's use of double agents operating in Britain.
Political cartoonist Neji al-Alali was born in 1937 in al-Sajara village in Palestine, prior to the Zionist occupation. Ali was 10 when the Nakba drove his family out of their village, forcing them to flee to Lebanon, where they lived in the Ain al-Helwa refugee camp in Sidon. He developed his talent for sketching sarcastic interpretations of the political landscape at the time. Ghassan Kanafani met Ali in the camp in the 1950s and helped him get work with a few newspapers. This eventually led to Ali moving to Kuwait to work for the papers Al-Siyasa and Al-Khabas through the 1960s and 1970s. It was in Kuwait that Ali developed the character he is most famous for, Handala. The depiction of a 10-year-old barefoot and bedraggled Palestinian child with his back turned became iconic across the world. Ali asserted that the character represented the condition of Palestinian refugees waiting to return. Ali's works were not just observational pieces on the Palestinian condition, but also piercing critiques of the major political actors of the day. His attacks on Gulf leaders are believed to be behind his decision to leave Kuwait with his family and settle in London in 1985. Ali had also begun criticizing the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat through his work, particularly the influence of a female companion on the figurehead. Ali was believed to have received more than 100 death threats before his liquidation in London. On July the 22nd, 1987, Ali was shot outside the office of Al-Khabas newspaper in Knightsbridge, London. He died around a month later. In the immediate aftermath of the killing, British police arrested Ismail Sowan, who was not only an employee of the PLO, but also an Israeli agent. The Israelis paid the rent for the very apartment that Sowan was arrested in by the British police. Sowan claimed that while he was not the killer, the team that carried out the assassination had used his flat as a base for operations. The British Prime Minister at the time, Margaret Thatcher, was so outraged at this information that she expelled the Israeli handler of Sowan and closed the Mossad base in Britain. The truth of Naji al-Ali's assassination is still unknown, but British police reopened the investigation in 2017.
Omar, I wonder if you could tell us about Naji al-Ali's character, Handela.
Yes, so Handela is a 10-year-old Palestinian refugee child, and in the classic pose, you know, that you see is barefoot and his back is facing the audience and hands clasped behind his back, and many believe that this is a kind of symbolism that denotes a rejection of outside or imposed solution to the Palestinian struggle. And Handela, of course, famously remains 10 years old, right, as Ali had wished for it to be, in part really, you know, symbolizing kind of the ongoing need for the total right of return of the Palestinian people to be implemented and something which has yet to be realized. And so in many cases, people see the perpetual youth of this character as kind of an artistic reflection, you know, of the ongoing need to kind of end this, you know, this colonially imposed atrocity and to finally allow the Palestinian people to return home.
David, in Kuwait seems to have been a hope for pro-Palestinian thinkers at different points, doesn't it? I mean, why do you think that was?
Well, I mean, Kuwait was had a policy of allowing Palestinian refugees to come and on preferential terms compared to other immigrants from the region. And so there were very many Palestinians in Kuwait working there, I think a quarter of a million or so, perhaps more. And it was so it was a kind of refuge for Palestinian refugees until, of course, the moment where there was the conflict over Iraq in 1990, when Iraq went into Kuwait, it seems that the apparent invitation of the Americans. And the PLO's view was to support Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And thus the Kuwaiti government expelled 250,000 Palestinians. And that was the moment which that was over, and that game was over. And most of the Arab states, of course, were opposed to Saddam Hussein in 1919, were effectively supporting the West in its military intervention. The Turkey Shoot, if you recall it was called, when they went in and killed thousands of people in the road to Baghdad. And so that was the formation of Kuwait. And of course, you see this process all the way through of the places that the Palestinians had to go to. They went to Jordan, they went to Lebanon, some of them went to Syria, or, of course, in Kuwait. And sometimes those places were closed down. Of course, famously, the Israelis forced the PLO out of Lebanon and sent them over to North Africa in the 1980s. So it's a process of where can these refugees go while they wait to come back to their homes, while they wait to expel the occupiers and to decolonize the occupation of Palestine. So that's the process, and that's why Kuwait was important then, and it became a terror incognito after that because they couldn't stay.
Well, Omar, I wonder what they might say. I mean, what kind of criticisms did Ali's work level at Yasser Arafat?
So many different types of criticisms, but really the thing to understand about Arafat is, you know, he has kind of a split. On the one hand, you know, seen as a very nationalist figure, very dedicated to the revolution. But what Ali was doing with Arafat, and to a certain extent, as he did with many politicians, was really trying to kind of probe beneath the surface and kind of expose what he felt to be a sense of hypocrisy. So this idea that, you know, there's a total dedication to Palestine, and yet there's an increasing number of decisions that are made that seem to be sort of conceding to the occupier, or, you know, moving toward a negotiated settlements rather than continuing, you know, kind of the armed liberation struggle. And of course, you know, for Ali, this was reflected in certain instances of personal corruption. But ultimately, really, the larger critique is this movement, this seeming concession, you know, that the Palestinian liberation under Arafat was making, moving toward a negotiated settlement rather than continuing, you know, a truly anti-colonial liberation struggle. And of course, this would include Ali's critiques, jibes, including, you know, cartoons sort of mocking him and mocking his cultural minister, Rashida Mahran. But the political substance of it really is this movement toward concession rather than, you know, and making these decisions that really aren't in the interest of the people.
No, absolutely. I mean, David, I mean, what do you make of these double agents arrested by British police following that killing?
Well, this is a very, very interesting tale. I mean, let's start with the fact that these people were working for Mossad. That whatever else they were working for, they were working for Mossad. And as you saw in the film there, Margaret Thatcher expels their handler, closes down the Mossad station. And people don't know this, do they? They don't know that actually that the Mossad was engaged in operations against Britain on British soil, that it was a hostile foreign power. And of course, as we've said in this program before, this is one of many examples where the British security state realizes that there's a problem here and it intervenes. And it was Thatcher who shuts down, of all people, the Mossad station. Now, of course, Thatcher has form in relation to Israel. And of course, there was a moment when she was Prime Minister where Menachem Begin came to the UK and she refused to shake hands with him because he regarded him as a terrorist. Now, there's the sign that even Tories can understand and get the point of this kind of spying in the UK. And Margaret Thatcher was up for that engagement. But let's go back to the other question. These were people who were PLO operatives. Were they PLO employees in the civilian sense, or were they armed operatives? And what's unclear about this is not whether the PLO and the Mossad were involved, but exactly what was the apportionment of responsibility. So it's not impossible that the PLO directed these killings, but at the same time, the people who were involved in the killings were actually Mossad double agents. I mean, we don't know exactly what the relationship was, but we already see the kind of dirty dealing and the double dealing of the PLO evident in this case, and that has only become much more significant. Mm. So that today we have the PLO engaged through the Palestinian Authority in security cooperation, including arrests and tortures of ordinary Palestinians, including killing ordinary Palestinians. Yeah. And we see that happening as the resistance rises in the West Bank. Now, we have a split, of course, in the Palestinian Authority. There are members of the PLO and Al-Aqsa Brigade, Martyrs' Brigades, who are joining with the Lion's Den or with Palestinian Islamic Jihad or with the Al-Qassam Brigades and joining the resistance, which is rising in the West Bank. And that's a split. And the more that split continues, the better. But we still see the Palestinian Authority collaborating directly with the Israelis. And that's, you know, truly appalling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that we are out of time today. So let me thank our guest, Omar Zaza, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next week, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
By one count, 44 states of the United States of America don't have air conditioning in all their prisons. 10 of those states are in the South, with a heat wave that has been unrelenting. In Mississippi, the Justice Department cited temperatures as high as 145 in the state penitentiary as among the conditions that violated prisoners' constitutional rights. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Throughout noted, days of extreme heat without access to enough water and cooled air become deadlier for an aging prison population in the United States. Recently, American guards found 37-year-old Elizabeth Hegatry dead in her on-air conditioned Texas prison cell. The day before, temperatures had reached nearly 100 degrees. Hegatry was scheduled for parole on August 2nd. She had been sentenced to 4 years in prison for not meeting the many requirements of her 10-year probation sentence for a fight with a woman. Her mother-in-law, Martha Romero, told Truthout that she had diabetes, asthma, and high blood pressure, but was otherwise healthy. In mid-June, Hegatry was transferred from an air-conditioned prison to the Dr. Lane Murray unit. 10 days later, she told Romero that she was feeling sick, could not keep food down, and had lost 12 pounds over the past week. 2 days later, she was dead.